This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In the fall of 2012, at the beginning of President Obama's second term, immigration was said to be the one policy area where Republicans and Democrats in Washington could find some common ground. But so far, that's not been the case, although in his State of the Union address, the president said he hopes that will change.
Yes, passions still fly on immigration, but surely we can all see something of ourselves in the striving young student and agree that no one benefits when a hardworking mom is snatched from her child, and then it's possible to shape a law that upholds our tradition as a nation of laws and a nation of immigrants.
But many Republican members listening to that speech were quite upset with the president because 2 months earlier, he went ahead on immigration without them. In November, Mr. Obama issued executive orders that effectively allowed 5 million people here illegally to stay. House Republicans, like New Hampshire Congressman Frank Ginta, were distressed at what they felt was an abuse of presidential authority and disrespect for the rule of law.
Our nation cannot send a signal that we won't enforce our laws or hold those responsible for breaking them. Our immigration system can be better. Compassion for people and care to faithfully execute our laws are not mutually exclusive.
Today in The Exchange, the impasse over immigration, what's going on now, what might be next, and possible impacts here in the Granite State. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests joining us for the hour. Songmin Kim is with us from D.C. She's a congressional reporter for Politico. She's reported extensively on the immigration debate on Capitol Hill. And Songmin, good to have you. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Also joining us, Jessica Vaughn, Director of Policy Studies at the Center for Immigration Studies. She's based in Massachusetts. The center is based in D.C. Jessica, good to have you, and welcome back to you, too.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And also with us in studio, Ron Abramson. He's a New Hampshire immigration lawyer, founder of Immigration Solutions. Ron himself is a naturalized citizen originally from Chile. And Ron, welcome back, and good to have you, too.
Good morning, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Well, Ron, and let's just walk through it, if we could, please. And I want to get everybody in this, but I'll start with you. Just clarify what the president did and didn't do in November.
Well, on November 20th, the president gave a long-awaited speech, and pretty much regardless of where you come at the issue, most people were waiting for this, some eagerly, some were more braced. But essentially what the president did was, in the absence of actual law, because no bill has come out of Congress, although the Senate did pass an overhaul and the House never brought it to a vote, the president said that as the executive and given the discretion the executive branch has for the enforcement of immigration law, the president was going to essentially reprioritize the way immigration law is enforced in this country.
And so what does that mean on the ground, Ron? And you may want to bring in, you know, a couple instances of people you work with in terms of who can stay without fear of deportation now and who can't.
It's a multifaceted plan, but the heart of it and the particular initiative that's generating all the buzz, if you will, is called Deferred Action for Parental Accountability, or called DAPA. And it's modeled a bit off of what was called DACA in 2012, which is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And basically this says that people who meet certain criteria, they need to have been here since January of 2010, they need to have a U.S. citizen child or lawful permanent resident child, they need to pass a rigorous background check, and they need to be current on all taxes, will be able to submit an application, be investigated, be adjudicated, and be allowed to stay for 3 years without being deported and or removed.
What has the president's actions meant for your practice, Ron? I'm just curious. Were you flooded the day after?
In the short term, nothing, because an announcement and the implementation of a program, there's necessarily a lag. The Department of Homeland Security, which oversees U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, is figuring all the details out, and we expect the policy to be implemented sometime in mid to late May of this year.
Well, and Jessica, I want to turn to you. How do you see these executive actions affecting the country, both in terms of, you know, practical terms, Jessica, and also political impacts? I know that some were upset that the president went around Congress. What does this mean practically, though, Jessica, on the ground?
Well, as a practical matter, what it means is that potentially about at least 4 million or more people who are here illegally will be able to have immunity from deportation and be able to get a work permit. And these are people who weren't eligible to work in the country before. In addition, a lesser discussed aspect of the president's action was to announce that nearly all of the other illegal aliens in the country will be immune from enforcement unless they have been convicted of a felony or a serious crime. So, and it also negates all prior enforcement action. So there is a de facto amnesty in place for most of those who won't be qualifying for the work permits. So this is more than just acting in the absence of law, as it was described. Of course, we do have immigration laws. The president has decided unilaterally that he doesn't agree with those laws and so is not going to enforce them. It goes beyond really just a matter of prioritizing who would be subject to enforcement. He's actually suspending enforcement and providing benefits to a huge share of the population that's here illegally. And, you know, the political impact of this has been quite negative for the president. You know, not only is he, you know, imposing fiscal costs and other problems on communities that are now going to be absorbing and, you know, and accommodating a huge new share of people who previously weren't eligible for benefits programs, for example, and to have jobs legally. It really complicates the task of trying to reach consensus on immigration reforms that would be broadly supported by the public and that would be fair to the 4.5 million people who are in line and have been sponsored by family members or U.S. employers to come here legally, because they're getting put really, you know, to the back of the line in terms of processing and so on. So it's going to have a lot of impact. There are going to be public safety impacts in our communities of people who should have been removed and aren't going to be. It's going to have an impact on those trying to bring people in legally. It's going to affect our labor markets, and it's going to affect the taxpayer, as they are now going to be on the hook for all kinds of services for people here illegally who didn't previously qualify for them.
Well, and I definitely want to ask all of you about the legal process in a few minutes, you know, some of the problems there. But to you, Songmin, just following up on what Jessica said, she said the president's actions make it harder to reach consensus on reforms. Here's my question for you and maybe everybody else, too. Why has it been so hard, Songmin, to reach consensus on this issue? After 2012, as I said in my introduction, you know, a lot of people said, okay, after the election, I think we can at least get together on immigration. That hasn't happened.
That's precisely right. It has been so difficult to try to get congressional consensus on the issue. And the basic reason is that just on immigration has always been a very difficult issue. I think it was difficult enough to get a coalition of senators together, and together we call that the so-called Gang of Eight. And even producing that bill was a major uphill battle and to try to get into the Senate. But you know, what happened in the House was even, it was probably almost never going to happen. I think Democrats mostly in Congress are on board with a comprehensive immigration overhaul. Obviously, every single Democrat in the Senate voted for it back in 2013. A lot of the division that you're seeing is coming mostly from the Republican Party. The Republicans are very united on the need for border security, more enforcement in the interior, but they're very divided on several key issues. And the biggest of them all, the most paramount of them all, is what exactly to do with that 11 million who are here, who are living here illegally. House Republican leadership last year, precisely about a year ago, endorsed a list of so-called principles that said, you know, we as a party want to endorse citizenship for those dreamers, the children who were brought here, who came here illegally as children, and perhaps a legal status in some sort of other fashion for the other other adults who are here illegally. But very few people in the House Republican Conference actually publicly endorse those principles. That effort went nowhere. And now that's kind of where we are right now. And obviously what the president did on executive actions last November really infuriated Republicans. One of the reasons that Republicans kept saying they couldn't do immigration reform, aside from the policy divisions in their party, was that they just couldn't trust the president to enforce immigration laws, pointing to the sweeping 2012 action regarding those dreamers and other enforcement policies dating back to 2011. And they pointed to those actions last November saying, look, here's just another example of why we cannot trust President Obama to enforce our immigration laws.
Well, and so the question for you, Ron, is did President Obama make it worse or better?
The argument that this somehow increases the burden on the taxpayer is a complete red herring. The people who are here in an undocumented status are already contributing, and they're already consuming. The children are attending school. The parents are working. There is actually a net revenue gain to the U.S. in terms of unclaimed taxes and other types of benefits. Also, the president's plan, DAPA, explicitly states that people are not eligible for public benefits. One example would be they're not eligible for any sort of subsidy or coverage under the Affordable Care Act. So these provisions are already addressed, and look, the president faces a lot of challenges in the last 6 years and in the remaining two. Angering Republicans is not one of them. He's figured that one out no matter what he says. If he acts, they're angry. If he doesn't act, they're angry. And this is just a case where the president waited, and some of us think he waited far too long, and finally said, since Congress won't act, I will.
Well, and everybody talks about, no matter what their view, talks about the need for, quote-unquote, comprehensive immigration reform. Maybe a little bit later in the hour, I'd love to hear from all of you on, okay, if that's so hard, why don't we just do it piecemeal? Why don't we do it bit by bit? Why don't we come together in the areas where we can agree and then work on the other stuff down the road? So we'll talk about that after a break. I also want to hear from you, Exchange listeners. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. 1-800-892-6477. Give us a call, your questions and comments about where we stand with immigration policy in this country and in New Hampshire. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, what's happening with immigration? Why it's so hard to reach some kind of agreement on this issue? Give us a call with your questions or comments, 1-800-892-6477. If you have personal experience with the immigration system, or just questions or thoughts about how it works, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Jessica Vaughn, back to you, this idea that, okay, maybe we can't get comprehensive immigration reform, which everybody says they want. What's wrong with doing it bit by bit?
I think it makes most sense to do it bit by bit because it is a complex issue and there are lots of different views on it. And that's the best way to get sound policy reform rather than trying to put together these massive bills that people don't have the chance to absorb that really end up being compromises among big special interests rather than the various viewpoints. And I think that's what the House of Representatives is starting on right now. They've started by introducing a border security bill, which is one piece of the larger enforcement picture, and they can move on from there. You know, the president has sort of put a lot of enforcement off the table now and, you know, decided to issue benefits to a large number of people, so there will be some attempts to possibly block at least the issuance of work permits to people. So that's going to, you know, that's another issue that could be clogging up the works a little bit, is, you know, Congress has to work out what's it going to try to do first, how does this fit in with the appropriations bills, and so on. But yeah, it makes perfect sense. Start with enforcement. When that seems to be working, then we can address other issues like perhaps adjusting the balance of legal immigration to better meet the needs of our economy by, you know, increasing the proportion of skilled immigrants who are arriving legally.
That's the H-1B visas, right, Jessica?
Well, I think people are thinking more of permanent green cards for people who are sponsored by employers and have skills and talents that we want to make a priority for legal immigration. And, you know, perhaps taking a look at other programs that have, you know, are no longer considered so valuable, like the visa lottery, for example. You know, there are lots of different things. Asylum reform is going to be a big issue. Our asylum system isn't working very well. It's rife with frivolous claims, people taking advantage of it. The immigration courts are overwhelmed. These are all issues that are complicated but desperately need policymakers' attention, and allowing them to focus on them one by one, I think, increases the chance of getting good reforms that will restore some integrity to the system we have while preserving our tradition of, you know, a generous immigration policy that doesn't affect the people in our society who are already struggling for opportunity.
Real quick to you, Ron, and then I do want to go to our listeners. What about the idea of just attacking it piece by piece?
Well, we've tried piece by piece, and so far we've ended up with a patchwork of largely inconsistent and incoherent laws going back to really the early part of the 20th century, which have inconsistent provisions, which hasn't seemed to work. We come up with one piece of legislation, then we don't fund it. You know, we seek to bludgeon the departments that are in charge with enforcing the law, with providing services, with protecting the borders. And it just seems that it is time to sort of break it down and address all the issues, given how different the world is now from what it was when we conceived of our current immigration system. And there is, in terms of something like what Jessica points out, there is common ground to be found, but people tend to be so politically entrenched in their concerns for what kind of ground they may yield or what sort of effect it may have on their quote-unquote base that we don't seem to get to the good faith discussion about the areas in which we could agree.
Let's take some calls, all of you. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, 1-800-892-6477. Ricky's in Manchester. Hi, Ricky. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So my wife is the lead nutritionist for the WIC program in the Northeast, and I am personally employed at Goodwill in Manchester, New Hampshire. And both our positions are populated by Nepalese immigrants. We have a very large Nepalese immigration population living in Manchester, New Hampshire. And these are just very kind people who work very hard, and they support local programs. And so there's this reality of the immigration debate in New Hampshire of, oh, well, they're here to take our jobs. And in reality, they're just such kind people, and they work hard, they pay with cash, and it's in support of programs that I don't necessarily see even from natural-born citizens. So without the support of these immigrants, you know, we wouldn't be able to exist, quite frankly.
Well, Ricky, thanks for calling in. And Songmin, I have a question for you stemming from that. But first to you, Ron, real quick. My understanding is many of the Nepalese people here in the Granite State are refugees, not necessarily immigrants, and there's a big difference.
Some are. Most of my Nepalese clients tend to have gotten their status through the diversity visa lottery or some other way, and they're bringing family members over when they become U.S. citizens, which is what the process provides for. So that community, by and large, at least in my experience, is fully documented and here legally. The distinction,
as immigrants or refugees?
As immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
Refugees are people who tend to be fleeing some sort of persecution or have already fled that persecution. And a refugee got that status when they were abroad. An asylee is a person who got here, requested that status, and then was granted it. And we've seen that, for example, with some of the Indonesian Christians who've resettled in the Dover area.
Or in the old days, Cubans would escape Cuba and claim political asylum in this country.
Right. That seems to be about to
change.
That's
a whole other story. We're not going to get into that right now. But Sungmin, to you, you know, Ricky raises a business point. And I do wonder, there's been a lot of discussion on the economic impacts of the lack of an immigration policy, of 11 million people here illegally, possibly now 5 million being allowed to stay without fear of deportation. What's the business community on Capitol Hill saying about the president's move on immigration and the impasse in general on immigration?
Immigration in general, the business community, the business lobby, actually have been pretty fervent supporters of immigration reform. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce was very involved in the failed effort back in 2006 and 2007 for a comprehensive immigration overhaul. They were also very involved in the latest effort back in 2013, where they struck that deal with the AFL-CIO, the major labor union, on a lower skilled guest worker program. So I think that for a lot of us in Washington, that was kind of the big sign that immigration reform could happen, because if the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO could agree on something, then anything could happen, right?
Yeah.
But the business lobby has always been very pro overhauling the immigration system to bring in more workers, both on the higher skilled end with the H-1B visas and other high-skilled visas, as well as the lower-skilled visas. We're thinking, you know, jobs in agriculture, construction, and other fields like that. So they actually weren't too pleased with the immigration actions that the president took. They had, especially the high-tech industry, had made a pretty big ask of President Obama when he and his aides were going through these administrative actions. They wanted to do what's so-called recapturing unused H-1B visas, which is, you know, taking those visas that hadn't been used in previous years and making them available for future years. A lot of what to do with these work visas are under the purview of Congress, and the president's advisors realized that he couldn't go that far and make it legally sound. They did make some changes that won some praise from the industry, but they didn't go as far as they hoped. And obviously, the industry put a lot of hope in the president's administrative actions, because they knew that action on Congress was going nowhere.
So the business community, the Chamber of Commerce and so forth, Sungmin, wants action on immigration broadly, but was less than thrilled with what the president did on his own. Is that what I'm hearing from you?
Basically, yeah. And I think just on the broader principle, they do, when the business lobby talks to Republicans who have been trying to work on immigration reform, who say, look, just the whole action make it harder for us to reach a consensus on a broader comprehensive legislative overhaul, I think they agree with that argument as well, and aren't really looking. I mean, there's some talk on Capitol Hill right now, but they aren't really looking at the possibility of a legislative overhaul at this moment.
Well, and Jessica, you mentioned earlier the H-1B visas, the permanent green cards is one area of possible agreement. Here's the complaint, though, that we hear in New Hampshire sometimes, Jessica, about these H-1B visas, is that manufacturers, high-tech companies, are using these H-1B visas to bring in foreign workers, pay them less, and not train Americans for these jobs. So, you know, companies, they say, are filling their quote-unquote skills gap with people from outside, when in fact some people would like them to invest in Americans more. I wonder what your thoughts are on that. And Ron, I want to hear from you too. But go ahead, Jessica.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's what I've been hearing from some folks in New Hampshire about the problems with the H-1B program. And the problems certainly are not limited to New Hampshire, but found all across the country, is that the biggest problem with the H-1B program is that it allows U.S. employers to bypass, and foreign employers to bypass U.S. workers in favor of guest workers from abroad who, through manipulation of the regulations, they're allowed to get away with paying much less. They classify them as trainees. They classify them as entry-level workers, when in fact they are, if they were a comparable U.S. worker with comparable skills, would have to be paid much more. And so that's why Congress has refused to go along with expanding these programs, when in fact, you know, all the academic literature shows that there is not a shortage of workers, American workers with these skills. The issue is that the employers would like to be able to get away with paying them less. So, that's true of other guest worker programs as well. But I think it's important to recognize that the reason some of the spokes organizations for big business are pushing for an expansion in both guest workers and legal immigration is because it does allow them to avoid rising wages for people in certain occupations. And that's the biggest impact of, you know, continuing a policy of mass immigration and, you know, extensive work permits and so on, is that we've seen that in certain industries in which there are a lot of immigrants working, both legal and illegal, that those wages have remained stagnant for decades now.
Ryan, can I get you on this too? Yeah, sorry to jump in on you, Jessica, there, but this is an important point that comes up a lot on our program, Ron, when we talk about skills gap, wages, and so forth. People do feel like companies are, I don't want to say abusing, but misusing the H-1B visas in order to pay people less and not train Americans.
Every H-1B filing starts with a specific form called a labor conditions application. And in that labor conditions application, you have to certify, the employer has to certify, that they are paying a prevailing wage. That prevailing wage is determined year after year after year based on employer responses to Department of Labor surveys. So that tends to track the actual prevailing wage in one of four experience categories or steps. And I'm not sure where some of this information is coming from, but it just does not play out in reality. I have employers who want to hire someone because they cannot find anyone. We do a prevailing wage determination, and then they say, oh, I can't pay that. It's too high. In other words, they would be raising the salary based on what they would otherwise expect to pay. So is there in any employment scenario the possibility for abuse? Of course there is. But H-1Bs have memo compliance requirements. They're subject to Department of Labor and immigration audits. And any aggrieved H-1B employee can file a complaint with USCIS and or the Department of Labor, and that employer is likely to be audited. And if they haven't complied with all the terms and regulations, they will be what's called debarred.
Why do I keep hearing these complaints then, Ron? I can't tell you how many times we've gotten callers and emailers on this program who feel this way.
Because every once in a while, Laura, the debate seems to rest on misinformation or at least a shaping of actual information that's not borne out in reality.
Our phone number again here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Wade's in Hillsboro. Hi, Wade. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Yeah. Laura, I'd like to take a couple of seconds and readjust the viewfinder here. We never talk about the root of the problem, which is that third world populations are just exploding. I spent the summer between high school and college, 1965, traveling in Mexico, and I love the country. But I remember now the first word of my travel tourist guide. It said Mexico is a country of 25 million people. I remember hearing on NPR in 2005, 40 years later, that the Mexican population was 107 million. That's more than quadrupled in 40 years. And no country can provide a good life for its people that quadruples its population in 40 years. And that's not just happening in Mexico. It's all over the world.
So relate this to the immigration conversation, Wade, please.
I think this is part of the root. This is the root of the problem. And I think the most important thing that we could do is to support things that will elevate the status of women in the third world.
So if the economy were doing well in Mexico and so forth, people wouldn't be...
Not just Mexico, but yeah. I think we've been pretty bad examples. a Republican administration in the early 80s torpedoed our own equal rights amendment. And ever since then, Republican administrations have been cutting funding for birth control clinics.
Well, wait, let's take the broader point, and thank you very much for calling. And Songmin, I'm guessing that this has come up on Capitol Hill, the idea that if conditions weren't so difficult in other countries, people wouldn't be coming here so much, and we wouldn't have this much of a debate going on. This happened, for example, when the Central American children were coming over the border, fleeing violence in their countries. I'd love your thoughts on this, Songmin, and thanks for the call, Wade.
And that's the argument that a lot of people who have been pushing for immigration reform have been making. I know a lot of people who are very opposed to legal status for the 11 million who are here illegally say, you know, they should do it the quote-unquote right way, the legal way, which is true. But at the same time, the legal way right now is very complicated. Most everyone agrees that the current legal status is very broken. If you look on the State Department's website and kind of look at this waiting list for how long it takes for citizens of various countries to get here working through the legal channels, I mean, waits can be as long as more than 2 decades, and that's been the problem with the immigration system that lawmakers have been trying to fix. So that is an argument that's been coming up a lot in conversation. Clearly, not enough to push reform over the finish line yet. But yeah, it's clearly a concern that's been out there.
Okay. Well, Wade, thanks again for the call. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number again is 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Pinkesh, who says, "I came to this country in 2003 as a student. Have been legal all this time. I work in New Hampshire on an H-1B visa." So we talked about that just a minute ago. He says, "I am one pink slip away from being deported. I invested 5 properties in the Great Recession. Why does everyone talk about illegal immigration? I am a highly qualified STEM graduate and employed for the past 9 years, paying taxes, all the bills, never had a speeding ticket, got pulled over by the police." Pinkesh says, "I believe people like me should be awarded the green card soon. Both Democrats and Republicans agree on the part of the immigration bill where it suggests to grant green cards for people like me." Pinkesh, thank you so much for calling in. Jessica, we're heading into a break, but just briefly, I'd love for you to address his thoughts there.
Well, I think a lot of people think that he would be an ideal candidate for a green card. The problem is that people also think we should be giving priority to close family members of previous immigrants or refugees. And most people agree that there needs to be a limit on total immigration. The difficult part is making the choice and then enforcing it.
All right. Well, coming up after break, we'll talk a lot more about this and take more of your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Thanks, Pinkesh, for that one. More of your thoughts and comments in just a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, a two-part program. First, we'll look at the Olympic dreams of Boston, which some feel could be a nightmare. Then in New Hampshire, the battle to save the bats. Send us an email on those topics before the program if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. Today in The Exchange, we're taking another look at immigration, given the impasse on this subject on Capitol Hill. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Songmin Kim is with us. She's a congressional reporter for Politico. She covers this issue extensively. Jessica Vaughn is here, Director of Policy Studies at the Center for Immigration Studies. And Ron Abramson, New Hampshire immigration lawyer, founder of Immigration Solutions. All of you, let's go back to our listeners. Donald's calling from Atkinson. Hi, Donald. You're on The Exchange.
Yeah. On H-1B visas, they discourage students from studying STEM subjects. I went to the U.S. First Robotics Kickoff, and I always ask the students if they're interested in coding. And one of them said, you know, why should I do that? Indians do that job. So that's one of the most detrimental effects of the H-1B visas, discouraging students.
So people think kids think it's not for them.
I mean, the Big Bang Theory, 20 million people watch that sitcom a week, has an H-1B character in it.
So what do you think, Jessica? I want to get Sung Min on this, too. And then I think I want to move on from H-1B visas because we talked a lot about that. But clearly that's one area where people here in New Hampshire are feeling this issue. What do you think, Jessica? H-1B visas discourages students from studying STEM. I'd love your thoughts on that. Also, your response, Jessica, to what Ron said earlier, that the wages H-1B visa folks are paid are, you know, driven by pure data.
Well, yeah, I mean, the data certainly show that there is high unemployment among American STEM graduates, that many of them are not working in STEM because there are no jobs available, and that there has been some displacement of American STEM grads and workers by companies who want to reduce their labor costs by bringing in workers from overseas. And again, our extensive research using the actual data from the federal government on H-1B workers finds that there is an overclassification of workers as entry-level and trainees who are, you know, not geniuses, Einsteins, you know, the next, you know, person who's going to cure cancer. They're ordinary workers working in jobs that Americans can do and used to do, but are being brought in because they're being paid less and often exploited by their employers. And that does have an effect over time of discouraging people from even going into those fields. And we also know that women and American minorities are also terribly underrepresented in STEM. And there is research that really points the finger at the H-1B program for distorting the labor market, particularly in STEM and IT occupations.
Well, Donald, thank you for that call. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You know, all of you, we talked a little bit earlier about border security, and certainly during the elections in 2014, that was a big issue when people talked about immigration. Sung Min, do you know, what is the status of border security? Everybody in this discussion says it's important. You talk to some people and it sounds like it's a military fortress at the Mexican border. You talk to other people and they say porous borders. What's the reality? How are we to figure this out?
Well, that's actually a very timely question because the Republican-led House is set to take up a border security bill this week at what its sponsor called the, quote, toughest border security bill ever. I know Jessica has a few disagreements with that statement, but what it basically does, the bill will come before a vote on Wednesday, and it does a variety of things. It calls for basically what's called operational control when you stop all illegal entries at the southern border within 5 years. It calls for a lot of technology, drones, additional fencing, I believe like 27 miles of additional fencing, and a bunch of other technology to crack down on security at the border. And the fact that they're addressing this first, you know, separate from the votes that they took earlier this month on overriding the president's executive actions on immigration, the fact that they're taking up this border security first, it shows that House Republicans, they still want to do immigration reform, and they want to show that what is at the top of their agenda is border security and making sure that is tightened before they move on to anything else.
Why is it so hard, Sung Min? I keep asking that question. Why is it so hard? Why is it so hard to come to an agreement on what a secure border means? I mean, again, you know, some people say, look, we're pouring millions of dollars for border security. There's armed guards everywhere. And other people say it's really, really easy to slip across. So it's just hard to even agree on what a secure border means.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think that you see a lot of disputes even with this legislation that's coming up for a vote this week. You know, it calls for the standard 100% operational control. Democrats say that's just a completely unrealistic standard. There are a lot of disputes from border towns, especially Democrats who represent these areas along the southern border, that say we don't want our communities, you know, what they say, it's going to militarize their towns. I think that was, even though the Senate immigration bill that passed 2 years ago had, you know, overwhelming support from Democrats and from advocates, there were some other immigration activists who said, who actually couldn't support the bill because, remember, it added 20,000 Border Patrol agents, mandated fencing, and put in tons of other technology to crack down on security at the border. But those
measures are precisely the types of measures that gets Republicans on board on immigration reform. And the other problem is, you know, it's not just security at the border that's a problem. It's this, also this issue of interior enforcement, which is immigration enforcement away from the border. I mean, you hear these statistics that say 40% of the undocumented population in the United States didn't come here illegally. They came here legally and overstayed a visa. So to crack down on enforcement, you have to do much more than boosting up security at the border.
That's interesting. Okay, so a lot of people who are here illegally were here legally at first and then just overstayed. It isn't that the whole illegal population is, you know, slipping over the border in the middle of the night.
Exactly.
Yeah. Another theme that keeps coming up in this debate, and Ron, I'm going to throw this one to you, is that people need to do this legally. It's not fair to those who are trying to do this the right way to be, quote unquote, put at the back of the line and so forth. What does it mean to become a legal immigrant? You know, let's say I live in, I don't know, Germany or wherever, and I want to become a legal immigrant of this country. I want to do it the quote-unquote right way. What does that take? What does that involve? Walk us through it.
That question's pretty broad, Laura, but basically it breaks down into one of two categories. A person can become a lawful permanent resident based on a family relationship, or a person can do so based on an employer-employee relationship. The family relationship tends to be the most direct. So you get married, basically. Married. You can become a citizen and then bring your adult parents over. You can bring your minor children over, that sort of thing. But where it gets complicated, if you are, let's say you travel abroad. I know you're happily committed, but let's say you weren't and you met somebody in Europe and you wanted to bring him over. Well, you would need to petition for him either as your fiancé, or you would need to get married abroad and petition for him that way. And then he would come in and he would get a conditional green card.
So it's not automatic.
Nothing is automatic.
And even if you're married.
Correct. There is no self-executing immigration status short of occasionally derivative or acquired citizenship based on birth abroad to U.S. citizen parents. Nothing is automatic. And this is a theme that comes up over and over again. People think it's easier than it is. In some cases, you know, in terms of these numbers about employers hiring foreign workers because it's easier and cheaper for them, when you factor in the uncertainty of business planning, when you factor in the costs in legal filing fees, when you factor in the costs in paying lawyers to bring people over, that's just not true. Every employer I've ever dealt with would rather find and hire a U.S.-based qualified worker than have to go abroad or have to recruit someone whose status in this country is uncertain. So in terms of answering your question, the process takes a long time, even if you don't have to wait based on something that's called priority dates for the various classes that don't have no quotas, in other words, that are limited. So that's where you get into a situation, I think Sungmin alluded to it earlier. If you're a Filipino sibling, if you're petitioning for your Filipino sibling, they can expect to wait 22 years.
22 years?
Correct, because the numbers that we allow to come in every year are so oversubscribed in that category that that's the backup. And those are congressionally mandated numbers. We have this diversity visa lottery. People from countries that we consider to be unrepresented or underrepresented can file, and it is literally a lottery. If they're chosen, they get to file for a green card. But nothing happens automatically. Everything involves significant fees, significant forms, significant processing times. And you know, none of this is simple. So if we fixed our system to make sense, our legal system, then we de-incentivize illegal immigration. If you make a family wait years and years and years to reunify, the moral choice is to break the law to be with your family. That's obviously against the law, but can we say it's immoral to want to join one's family when they are already there and they're trying to do it, quote, legally? During his first term in Congress, I met with Frank Ginta, and he said to me directly, Ron, I don't have a problem with legal immigration, but you know, if these people did things legally, it would be okay. So I said, Representative, you're in Congress. Make it legal.
So you're saying our immigration system divides the world up. For people from country X, it's incredibly hard. It takes 2 decades. And from people from country Y, it's a much easier, quicker process.
Not quite. We treat everybody the same except for the 4 countries that are hugely oversubscribed, and that's Mexico, China, India, and the Philippines. Those are the 4 countries.
We just feel like we have too many people from those countries.
Well, we do. I mean, the numbers there are very documentable. And they, those are the countries that, depending on the classification, may need to wait a little longer or a lot longer than the rest of the world.
All right, let's take another call. Jonathan's joining us from Manchester. Hi, Jonathan. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning. I have 2 points. The first, which is that we tend to blame the people who come up here to work, but the truth is that the agricultural industry in this country would not function without illegal workers. And the restaurant industry in a city like New York City functions in the kitchens and in the dishwashers and the bus people particularly, that they need, there's no way that those industries would survive without, because they couldn't afford to pay someone a working wage or a legal wage. And the other thing, based on what your guest was just saying, is I do notice that in certain industries and in certain social classes, there's a huge amount of people coming in from places like Britain and Australia, where they actually have there are people help them get in here. I mean, in journalism, the amount of people, and in entertainment, the amount of people that come in from London and England that have jobs that could easily be fulfilled by people who take communications courses in this country and do not have those jobs.
Well, Jonathan,
the color of the skin and the tone of the voice has everything to do with it.
Thank you very much for calling in. And Jessica, to this economic point that Jonathan raises, I remember a couple of years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, there was a move by some states, mostly down south, to pass laws against illegal immigration state by state. And then farmers complained that they didn't have workers to pick their sweet potatoes and their tomatoes. So I just wonder what you think about the economic argument that our caller Jonathan makes.
Well, I think any industry that, as its business model, relies on illegal workers could be in trouble if immigration laws were ever to be enforced. But, so you really have to ask yourself, there were a lot of stories about, the crops rotting in the field stories. You know, the problem is that many of these industries have become addicted to underpaid workers that are easily exploitable. And the studies show that if those workers were to get just a small increase in their wages, the increase in those products for the consumer would be negligible. And yet the benefits for those workers would be huge. Agriculture workers make up a very tiny share of the illegal immigrant population. It's only about 5%. And I think that's why Congress would really like to move forward on an agricultural guest worker program. In fact, there was one that passed the House of Representatives Judiciary Committee a couple years ago that was a compromise between the employers and the workers groups. So there, and I myself as a consular officer certainly issued a lot of visas for temporary agricultural workers, and I saw that those programs can work if they are structured correctly to make them truly temporary, so they don't exploit the workers, that they pay a decent wage and don't displace American workers. It's possible to do that if we break down this issue into parts that can be reasonably addressed through focused legislation and not try to, throw everything into an omnibus bill that's going to make everyone mad. And I think that's what we're going to see over the next couple of years, that programs like this get examined much more closely.
Well, and Song Min, I'll finish out with you then. On that note that Jessica leaves us on, which is, what's next? Are we going to see this continued movement or continued question about comprehensive immigration reform? Will people say, look, it's just too hard, let's do it piece by piece? What do you think?
I think there's going to be a little bit of movement, but no movement that actually reaches President Obama's desk. I mean, we talked a little bit earlier about the border security measures that are coming before the House this week. We can also expect to see some interior enforcement measures as well. The Senate looks like some key senators are working on their own legislation, but it sounds like they kind of want to defer to the House on what they are planning to do on immigration. But congressional Republicans and President Obama are so far apart on what really constitutes immigration reform. Obviously, the president's executive action has taken the threat of deportation off for, millions of people here in the United States. I think that does give a little less of an urgency among Democrats to push hard on an immigration immigration overhaul. So as long as those two elements are there, I don't think you can expect to see something anytime soon.
And Sungmin, we'll probably hear about it, though, in the 2016 presidential election, right? I mean, candidates in Iowa were talking about it.
Exactly. I mean, you saw a lot of that over this weekend when Congressman Steve King of Iowa, who is a very vocal immigration critic, hosted, you know, a slew of presidential hopefuls in Iowa over the weekend. As we know, Iowa plays a critical role in the presidential nominating process. And while, I mean, from all the coverage I read, a lot of the issues immigration was just one of many issues discussed at this forum on Saturday, but clearly it's going to be the one that gets one of the most attention from the media and also from activists. We saw a group of these so-called Dreamer activists in Iowa interrupt former Texas Governor Rick Perry's speech when he was talking to conservative activists. The Governor Perry responded with a kind of a rallying cry for the need to secure the border, saying the president hasn't done it. Texas did when he was governor last summer. He deployed the National Guard to the border. You'll expect to see immigration still to be a very big issue in 2016.
Okay. Sungmin, I got to cut you off there. Right. Thank you so much. We'll be watching this as a presidential issue for sure. Thank you, everyone, for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
All right. Thanks for having us.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.